From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Did you know that Merck spent more money promoting Vioxx than Anheuser-Busch spent promoting Budweiser and PepsiCo spent promoting PepsiCola in the year 2000?
Hooked on drug companies, the pharmaceutical industry spends billions on gifts for doctors to persuade them to prescribe their medicines. Critics say it's bad for patients' wallets and maybe their bodies. A coalition emerges to make comprehensive health care a reality by 2004. Today, we'll talk about the case for universal health care with a man who would like to be president. He's the governor of Vermont and a doctor, Howard Dean. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Public confidence in the so-called war on terror is at an all-time low since September 11th. A new USA Today CNN Gallup poll has found that only one in three Americans say the U.S. is winning the war. Only half of those polled say the U.S. should mount a long-term war to defeat global terrorist networks. Almost three-quarters of those asked say they approve of the job President Bush is doing. The General Accounting Office warned a House panel Tuesday that President Bush's proposed Homeland Security Department could hurt public health. Bush has proposed transferring some public health functions from the Health and Human Services Department to the new agency. The GAO says the plan doesn't provide a structure that can meet the day-to-day vital needs of public health agencies and hospitals, such as reporting on disease outbreaks. 10 Pakistani soldiers were killed today in a gun battle that broke out as they raided houses near a town in Pakistan's northwest frontier province. According to a Pakistani military statement, they were killed by suspected al-Qaeda fighters. They're the first known combat deaths suffered by Pakistani soldiers since the government sent troops to the Afghan border last year. The nation's second-largest long-distance phone company on Tuesday admitted orchestrating a multi-billion-dollar accounting fraud. WorldCom says its profits were inflated by nearly $4 billion. The firm sacked its chief financial officer, Scott Sullivan, and immediately laid off 17,000 workers. Arthur Anderson, who audited WorldCom's records until recently, tried to blame Sullivan for the scandal. The WorldCom revelation is the latest in a series of developments that have spawned new mistrust of corporate America and thrown into question much of the incredible business growth of the late 1990s. The Washington Post is reporting the Justice Department has begun a criminal investigation. The Palestinian Authority has announced presidential and legislative elections will be held next January. The move comes 2 days after President Bush told the Palestinians to elect new leaders, quote, not compromised by terror. Surrounded by Israeli tanks, Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat told reporters that only the Palestinian people can determine who their leaders will be. Israeli forces are now holding 7 of the main Palestinian population centers and have placed at least 700,000 people under virtual house arrest. International activists report troops are bulldozing homes, throwing percussion grenades, and firing machine guns into the air in the middle of the night. A journalist for the Israeli newspaper Yediot Aharonot is reporting that Bush's speech outraged the Israeli foreign minister Shimon Peres. As he watched Bush talk, Peres said over and over, quote, he is making a fatal mistake. Peres turned off the TV in the middle of the speech and said, the abyss into which the region will plunge will be as deep as the expectations from this speech were high. There will be a bloodbath. A Belgian appeals court ruled today that Belgium cannot investigate war crimes charges against Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Survivors charge Sharon is responsible for the 1982 massacre of hundreds of civilians in the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in southern Lebanon. The three-judge panel said a case cannot proceed against a person who is not in Belgium. Under the cover of his much-publicized speech on the Middle East, President Bush quietly signed a bill allowing death benefits to be paid to the gay partners of firefighters and police officers who die in the line of duty. The bill permanently extends a federal death benefit to same-sex couples for the first time. The new law allows a $250,000 federal benefit for survivors of public safety officers to be paid to any beneficiary listed on the victim's life insurance policy. The Justice Department lobbied against the bill, writing in a letter to Congress saying the benefit had been designed for immediate survivors with pressing needs and that the bill was, quote, likely to create unintended and unfortunate results. Come on, what we got to say? Yeah. Fight the power.
What we got to say? Now that's heavy. The military quotes me. Listen to this here. No, this is heavy. This is out of the little booklet that was published for the high crooks in the medical world there at Walter Reed's in Washington, D.C. Now, if the politicians print this up for themselves and don't tell the people, because lots of doctors in this country use hers, but they'll give you that old crooked medicine. I'm going to come on with that. Listen to what it says here. When you eat foods that make your stomach hurt, stop eating them. Ain't that heavy? Do not take medication to stop the gas and pain. Stop that food. Oh, that's heavy. Your common sense will tell you not to eat certain foods just because someone else does. Ain't that heavy?
Fight the Power, Public Enemy, mixed with Hobo Herbalist, the late Dr. John Moore. Here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio, I'm Amy Goodman. Lawmakers, activists, health experts gathered on Capitol Hill Tuesday to announce a new coalition to put universal health coverage back on the nation's agenda. The coalition is spearheaded by Democratic Congressmember John Conyers of Michigan, a staunch advocate of universal health care. Conyers has also recently introduced a House resolution backed by 85 co-sponsors that would direct Congress to enact legislation for comprehensive health care by October 2004. The health care reform was a prominent issue in the 2000 presidential campaign, but the attacks of September 11th and the so-called war on terror have shifted political attention away from the issue. The government spends more money on health care than any other country in the world, but one out of seven Americans has no health insurance. Millions more cannot afford vital medical services. We'll be joined by a fierce advocate for universal health care. We're going to be speaking with Dr. Rudolf Mueller, who spoke at yesterday's event announcing the formation of a universal health care task force. Dr. Mueller practices internal medicine as is an assistant professor of medicine at the State University of New York at Buffalo. He's also the author of the recently published book, As Sick as It Gets, documenting his experiences in treating uninsured patients. And we'll be joined by the governor of Vermont. He's a medical doctor, Dr. Howard Dean, and he would like to be president of the United States. We're going to talk with him not only about the issue of health care, but the influence of drug companies on doctors and politicians and what's being done about it. We'll have a roundtable discussion with doctors and medical students who are leading a campaign to reduce that influence. First, Dr. Robert Mueller, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you talk about the news conference yesterday?
Oh, it was great. It was really exciting. There were people from all across the country that represented all various different groups. There's over 340 different national organizations that support this legation, that religious groups, the NAACP, disabilities, the community.
Can you talk about the legislation?
It's called HCON Resolution 99, and it's a healthcare access resolution. It calls for affordable, comprehensive healthcare for all people, universal access by October of 2004.
And how would that be accomplished?
Well, it's a resolution that, calls that healthcare is a human right and that all people in this nation deserve decent healthcare, and it's calling for comprehensive health care.
How, though? What would the government do?
Well, it doesn't say how to do it. It doesn't, whether it's multi-payer, single-payer, government's going to do this. There would be a debate how to do it, and I believe it needs to go to a single-payer, but it's not saying that it has to do that. It's just that we agree that health care is a right, that everyone deserves quality, affordable, accessible health care, and this is the start.
We're also joined on the phone by Dr. Howard Dean, who's governor of Vermont. Governor Dean unveiled his own plan for universal health coverage earlier this month. Can you talk about your plan?
Sure. I've been doing this for 20 years, and there are lots of different ways to do it. I think we have to focus first on not so much fighting among ourselves about how to do it, but get it done. We've tried to do this three times at least since 1950, and we can't afford another 10 or 12-year period where people go without health insurance because we can't figure out how we agree to do it. My plan is very simple. It's based on the Vermont plan. 96% of all our children in Vermont have health insurance, and another 3% are eligible for our program but haven't signed up. So we essentially have universal health care for everybody under 18 in the state of Vermont. I would expand that to 22 for the whole country and have the states do it based on a Medicaid program. We call ours Dr. Dinosaur, but it's Medicaid-based. And that would really take care of everybody under 22. Over 65, Medicare is not a bad program, except that it needs a prescription benefit. If you do the prescription benefit, then everybody over 65 has a reasonable insurance program. Between 22 and 65, I would not radically reform health care, not because it may not need it, but because we can't get it passed. We've seen that in 1993 when the Clintons took on every interest group in Congress at once. Harry and Louise scared the daylights out of American people who had health insurance and convinced them, I think falsely, that anything we did would hurt their insurance. So I think we ought to use the present system, the employer-based system. We ought to use some federal subsidy money to help small businesses, people who work for small businesses, self-employed people, and people who work for big corporations part-time that don't get benefits. That's what we've done in Vermont with kids, and we've gotten up to 96%. I think we ought to reverse the way the Democrats have tried to do this in the past. Instead of having the debate about delivery systems, let's just get it done based on the current system, which you could do if you'd roll back the fiscally irresponsible tax cuts that the president passed, and then you could invest in a health care system for all Americans.
Is Vermont the only state in the country that is providing this kind of comprehensive health care, at least to kids?
As far as I know, it is. I know that Tennessee comes close with 10 care, but I don't think there are many states that cover most every child under the age of 6, but none that I know of that go up to 18.
Dr. Mueller, can you talk about how the country can afford single payer and what the term single payer means?
Single payer, what we could do is Medicare. If you took Medicare and expanded it to the entire population, that would be single payer. It doesn't mean the government tells the doctor how to take care of patients. It's just they collect the money through taxes, and then they pay the providers and the hospitals and et cetera. And I think that's the way to go, because in 1998, we spent $90 billion in all these different multi-payers, and the bureaucracy is unbelievable. Going to a single payer will save a lot of money that could go back to taking care of patients, providing prescriptions, you know, coverage and et cetera, home health care, the things that we need to do. So I think keeping this multi-payer, it's just more bureaucracy, more red tape. It would be much simpler to go to a single payer.
And what do you mean by multi-payer?
Well, we have 1,500 different insurance companies, and the red tape is just, it's enormous. It's huge. The cost to the hospitals, the providers, and on and on. And it's just a waste of money. And I just see so much waste. There's enough money in the system right now to take care of everyone and provide quality, affordable, accessible health care for everyone.
Governor Dean, why do you sort of veer away from single payer?
Because we can't get it past Congress, plain and simple. The insurance companies, the drug companies, everybody has so much money going into the campaigns of various congressmen that it's not going to pass. It didn't pass. It has never passed. The Democratic Party almost came apart over this issue in 1993 when the president tried to pass health care. I agree with many of the things that Dr. Mueller has said, and there are a lot of inefficiencies in a multiple-payer system. But let me tell you this story. I gave a speech to 1,000 Democrats in Minnesota a couple of months ago about health care. A lady came up to me afterwards and said, Governor, I'm 75 years old. Don't you take away my health care? And I said, what do you mean? She said, my husband used to work for Owens Corning, and he's passed away, but he left me a very good health care package because of his retirement. Don't you take it away. Harry and Louise, you remember those Harry and Louise ads where these people would get on and talk about the Clinton health care plan? and how it was going to take away everything from them. They'll be back. The reason I wanted a multi-payer system has nothing to do with whether single payer is any good or more efficient or not. It has to do with what we can get past. And I'm tired of having the fights about whether we should have this system or that system. Get people insured. Then if the system isn't working properly, we can make some adjustments. We've got to get people insured. We've got to get Americans used to the idea that health care is part of their birthright as an American. Once you do that, then we can adjust the system if we have to.
Well, that's what HCON resolution is that every, you know, that it is a right and that everyone's going to be covered and by 2004, and then there will be a debate. Do we leave the present system and expand it to everyone? Is it single payer? Is it some other system? I mean, all the other wealthy democracies in the world provide quality, affordable health care to all of their people, and not all of them are single payer or government run, or there's multi-payer systems that do work, like in France and Japan. So,
and Germany also. Yeah, I agree. I think we're on the same wavelength. Let's get this thing done, and then if it needs to be reformed, well, let's just work through the reforms. But get people covered.
I want to get them covered too, and we need to do it because the costs are exploding, and I think they're exploding because people, the uninsured, are crashing into the system. They're going without care, and then they're coming in sicker, costs even more, and then, you know, some recover, many don't, and the costs are just exploding, probably because we're not taking care of everyone.
How would you deal with an issue like this? African Americans receiving poorer medical care than whites in areas ranging from diabetes to mental health. This is according to researchers at Harvard University in one of the broadest studies of the racial disparities in health care to date. For the first time, researchers looked at federal quality control records for patients in Medicare managed care plans. They found African Americans were less likely to receive adequate care in all four areas measured: eye exams for diabetics, preventive drugs for heart attack, breast cancer screening, and follow-up care after leaving a mental hospital. And they said the differences are not fully explained by socioeconomic gaps.
I think one of the issues is you have to have more minority representation in medical schools. If you had the group of doctors in America looking like the rest of the population, my suspicion is that some of those statistics would improve.
Governor Dean, have you announced your plans to run for president?
No, I'm going to announce in January. We have already, though, officially filed. I come from a small state, and I've got to get my name out there and work pretty hard over the next 2.5 years to get known. Actually, I'm doing this interview from Iowa, which is the first caucus state. Health care is front and center in my campaign. I mean, there are a lot of important issues, and you talked in the news headlines about the lack of trust for business because of what's happening in Enron, and that's certainly a big issue here as people are worried about their jobs. But I think universal health care or health insurance for everybody is the critical issue, and it ties into economic security and it ties into the financial future of the country.
How do you plan not to get whacked like Clinton did when he didn't even go half as far as what you're talking about or what Dr. Mueller's talking about or most people who are concerned about universal health care?
I think you have to understand that the American people are conservative with a small c. They say they want change, but they want incremental change. What we did in Vermont was every year, piece by piece, we put in more health care for kids. And I've been there for so long now, 11 years, that we basically had universal health care before the right wing knew what we were doing. Then they protested against it, and they got clobbered at the polls because people, even conservative Republicans, have small kids and don't make a lot of money sometimes, and they realize that their kids get insurance even if they can't have any. So it's become a middle-class entitlement. People really want it, and they're not going to support people who go after it. And that's what I would do in the presidency, is simply add piece by piece. What I've suggested is essentially an incremental program. It takes, at least for Vermont, I suppose from other states that haven't gone as far as we do, it's a bit more. But you insure children, you insure seniors through programs that exist by just expanding them, and then you expand the system for the people in the middle, the employment people. You can say to 80% of the American people, look, your system's not going to change. Don't worry, you're still going to get your health care the same old way. So all the interest groups that are trying to kill the system or kill the proposal are not going to be able to say to people, oh, your health care is going to be taken away. We're just simply going to add for those people who don't have it. And then if you have to perform the system, we can have that big battle, but at least everybody will have health care at that time, and you won't be able to take it away because it'll be a political disaster to do so.
Governor Dean, I'm curious, in the news headlines I also read that under the cover of his much-publicized speech on the Middle East, President Bush quietly signed a bill allowing death benefits to be paid to the gay partners of firefighters and police officers who die in the line of duty. Vermont is well known for the civil marriage.
Civil unions bill, right.
The civil unions bill. Right. Is this something that you'd like to see throughout the country?
Well, that's really a matter for the states. One of the things I've been appalled by the president is that he's taken over so much state function. He's mandated that each school, for example, report that they allow school prayer, that each school allow the Boy Scouts to meet there, that every school give the names of the seniors and the juniors to military and colleges and all that. And that may be fine and good, but that seems to me that that's the prerogative of the local school board, not the president of the United States, to make those kinds of decisions for their kids. And I'd like to see states and local people have more say over their lives. So I don't think that, I do believe, our civil unions bill basically says that marriage is between a man and a woman, and that's up to the church, but that under the law, everybody will have the same rights, so that gay and lesbian couples essentially have the same rights as I do in terms of insurance or being able to visit your spouse or any of the other things that being married brings along from a legal point of view. I wouldn't mandate that every state in the country pass a civil union bill, but I do believe that every state in the country has to deal with equal rights for everybody, and that includes in terms of sexual orientation.
We're going to break for music for 60 seconds. When we come back, we're going to take this discussion to the power of the drug companies. Our guest, Dr. Howard Dean, governor of Vermont in Iowa right now, getting ready for his bid for president of the United States. Dr. Robert Goodman will be joining us, who has begun a campaign, nofreelunch.org. And we're going to talk about doctors and speak with the head of the American Medical Students Association about the power of drug companies, not only over politicians, but over doctors and what Vermont and other states are doing about it. Stay with us.
Did I drink some poison? Did I drink some poison? That I don't remember now. Is the blood on my hands? No, my hands are clean. Did I do something in another lifetime? It was really, really me. Yeah, I'm hearing voices. Am I losing my mind? Think I'm going crazy, gotta get out. Running into the street, start to shout. Get out of my way, get out, get out. Did I drink some poison that I don't remember now? Is the blood on my hands? Did I do something in another lifetime? It was really, really me.
Poison, Laurie Anderson, here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Last week on Democracy Now!, we reported on the multimillion-dollar, well, what some have called President Bush's drug gala. The Republican fundraiser hosted by the president, underwritten by the pharmaceutical industry. Drug companies paid as much as $250,000 for a seat at the legislative table. Just 2 days before the drug gala, Republicans unveiled a prescription drug plan backed by the industry. Just one day after the gala, the House Energy and Commerce Committee approve the plan. In fact, the Republican Congress members left the debate over prescription drugs early in order to make it to the drug company-sponsored event in the evening. But legislators are not the only ones hooked on drug companies. Doctors are also targets. Pharmaceutical companies shower physicians with gifts, lunches, concert tickets, free vacations to promote their products. Some marketers pay doctors to write so-called research articles on their drugs in medical journals. In some cases, the companies hire marketing firms to write the first drafts. These tactics have prompted a growing chorus of criticism from doctors and patient advocates who say the junkets erode the integrity of the medical profession. National organizations such as the American Medical Association and the American College of Physicians have recently issued guidelines regarding these gifts, but many say they don't go far enough. Democratic Governor Howard Dean of Vermont recently signed a bill that requires drug companies to report to the state any gifts to doctors worth more than $25. Doctor and Governor Howard Dean, can you talk about this bill?
Sure. What the bill actually has three parts of it. The other parts have to do with prior authorization and with increasing Medicaid rebates, supplemental rebates. What we're trying to do is simply bring market discipline to the pharmaceutical industry. The pharmaceutical industry has avoided, mostly through its power in Congress, the necessity to compete based on price, unlike every other business in the world. They have prevented reimportation. They extend their patents using loopholes so that they don't have to compete with generics. They actually have paid, in some cases, generic companies not to produce drugs in order not to have competition. What we're going after in this particular bill, with the particular feature of it that you talked about, which is actually not the most important feature, is simply openness. We require people who give money to congressmen or lobbyists who spend money trying to influence Congress to simply make those donations and those expenditures public. We know that drug companies lobby doctors to provide certain drugs to their patients. We simply want to make those emoluments public, and we think what will happen is when we do make those public, the drug companies are now required to give them to the health department. They'll probably end up on the web. Is that most doctors will refuse those gifts because they won't want to be seen in that way, and the public will make their own judgment about whether these are improper influences or whether these are proper influences. We exclude free drugs. We do that not because we do it with a light heart. We realize that that does influence prescribing habits, but we do think, and I think from my own personal experience as a physician, that the free samples that we get from pharmaceutical companies help our patients. And so we did not include that in the legislation.
How tough was it to get this legislation passed?
Well, pharma wasn't very happy about it. I think pharma is making a mistake. This is basically not an evil industry. They produce products that save people's lives, and they're extraordinary products in many cases. But the leadership in pharma is behaving as though they're the tobacco industry with their tactics. They're not interested in coming to the table. They fight everything with a blowtorch, scorched earth approach to things, and eventually they're not going to win this fight. I wish that they would take a different, more constructive approach, more in line with the kind of role that they play in society, which is, after all, a helpful role, making products that help people rather than, unlike the tobacco companies, that kill people. But they haven't taken that approach. They use a scorched earth policy at every possible turn, and I think they're probably the second most hated group in America right now after the tobacco companies.
Well, we actually have a representative of pharma on the line, Dr. John Kelly, who's with the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. That's what pharma stands for. Senior Vice President for Scientific and Regulatory Affairs. Your comment on the Vermont bill, the law that has just been enacted.
To agree with Dr. Dean on the tremendous value that pharmaceuticals provide, and there certainly has been some concern over marketing practices, and so to try to help correct that, what pharma has recently done is to reaffirm our commitment to appropriate marketing, and so we've adopted a code which becomes effective on July the 1st, which is next Monday, that emphasizes that the interaction between pharmaceutical companies and physicians should focus on informing the healthcare providers about scientific and educational information, that it should be for the benefit of the patients, that educational and practice-related items of the sort that Dr. Dean emphasized can be provided as long as they benefit the patients, and that all items of personal benefit to the professional should not be offered. In short, nothing should be offered or provided that would interfere with the independence of the healthcare professional's prescribing practices. We think that that's the right way to go.
We're also joined in the studio by Dr. Robert Goodman, Assistant Professor of Clinical Medicine at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. He's the founder of No Free Lunch. Your response on the issue of the power of the pharmaceutical industry and whether this code of conduct would be enough.
I think the code of conduct will help. The industry spent about $16 billion last year promoting its products to doctors. About half of that was on the free samples that Governor Dean mentioned. I think the voluntary code, although voluntary, will help because I don't think the industry needs any more bad publicity. And if things happen, if reps take doctors out to baseball games or Broadway shows which are in violation of the code, and this gets reported to the public, who's now very well aware of these new guidelines, I think it will actually put an end to this sort of thing.
Can you talk about your campaign?
Our campaign is actually not directed primarily toward the industry, but to physicians themselves. Because, of course, the industry is sworn to its stockholders, and its main intent is to make profits, whereas doctors are sworn, have taken an oath to do the best thing for their patients. And what the literature clearly suggest is that when doctors practice on the basis of promotion rather than medical literature, they don't always do what's best for patients. In other words, they may prescribe inappropriate medication, may prescribe expensive medication. So what we want to do is encourage and help doctors to just say no to all the types of pharmaceutical industry largesse that they've become accustomed to accept in past years.
So what are you doing? Can you talk about, it seems to be modeled on the gun exchange program.
Part of it. We do have a pen amnesty program, our Pens for Pens program, which was modeled on the gun exchange program that took place in started in Washington Heights, where I actually practice medicine. So we are trying to clean up some of the pharmaceutical industry pens that most patients have seen littering doctors' offices. In addition to that, though, we're trying to provide information to physicians as well as the public, convincing them that, in fact, promotion does influence their behavior. Because, of course, if you talk to any physician, most often the response you get, look, you know, I may do this stuff, I may eat the food, I may go out to these events, but it doesn't influence my behavior at all. But the obvious response to that is, well, then why is the industry spending billions and billions of dollars doing this? Obviously, they know that it works and it does influence behavior.
Dr. John Kelly, your response.
Well, I think that, Ms. Goodman, there are just tremendous unmet medical needs in this country, as Dr. Dean, Dr. Goodman know. High blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, mental health disorders. At the same time, during the last decade, hundreds of new drugs have been discovered, developed, and made available. And so it's our view that it's very, very important that physicians have access to this information, understand the choices that are available to them to care for their patients. We also think it's important for patients to know what some of the choices are that are available to them. We think it's a very, very helpful way for physicians who need access to this information to know how best to meet the needs of their individual patients.
Dr. Bob.
Well, there's no question that physicians need access to up-to-date information. But the response is a little bit outdated because maybe 15 or 20 years ago, what a doctor would have to do to get information about a drug would be go to the library, look for a medical journal, photocopy the journal, read the entire article. But of course, in the past few years, with the advent of computers and the World Wide Web, there are many, many sources of information, non-industry related, non-biased sources of information that doctors can access literally in seconds with a patient sitting right there in front of her, and there's no need for doctors to get information from salespeople.
Let me also chime in.
Governor Dean.
As long as we have Dr. Kelly here, let me put in a pitch for the industry stopping direct consumer advertising. That is really destructive. There's no discussion of price. It is, we're having to deal with this with prior authorization. Nexium, for example, which is highly advertised, has very little improvement over Prilosec. It's simply an attempt to extend the patent and keep the price up. And we actually we put in prior authorization, so you can't get Nexium in our state if you're on Medicaid, which is about a fifth of all the people in the state because of our expanded health care programs. And the amount of money that's spent on that drug has just plummeted. Now, you know, if you didn't have direct consumer advertising, my guess is that patients wouldn't come in and ask for that drug and doctors wouldn't prescribe it. It's another way of influencing physicians through their patients, and it's not particularly helpful to the practice of medicine. I'd prefer that doctors get their information even from detailed guys rather than directly from consumers who see the ad on the evening news. And there's nothing we can do to stop the industry from doing it because it's protected commercial speech, but I wish the industry would voluntarily not do that.
Dr. Kelly.
Well, we think that an informed healthcare consumer is really a very, very important direction to go. And so we think that direct-to-consumer advertising, as well as the kind of information which is available on the Internet to help consumers better understand what their health care needs are and some of the options that are available to them. And then at the same time, we think it's very, very important that physicians, who really play the critical role in working with their patients, have choice, have an opportunity to decide what meets, what's best for an individual patient. And a drug that may be appropriate for one patient may not be appropriate for another patient. And so, again, we think that free access to information, whether it comes from a drug company representative, from a medical journal, or from the internet, are all valuable ways to help inform the physician as well as to inform the public.
Speaking of medical journals, this piece I'm looking at, Newsday of last week, the distinguished New England Journal of Medicine is relaxing its strict conflict of interest rules for authors of certain articles because it can't find enough experts without financial ties to drug companies. The change announced in the issue of June applies to experts who write either editorials or review articles, which are overviews of research on a particular drug or treatment rather than original studies. The journal's editor-in-chief said the policy reflects the way drugs are developed nowadays. He said new treatments are brought out by investigators whose research is in part supported by industry. They're the ones who know about new stuff. The change brings the journal's policy into line with that of other medical publications, such as the Journal of the American Medical Association. Original studies in the New England Journal of Medicine will continue to include a note saying who sponsored the research and disclosing any financial stake the author might have. Dr. Bob Goodman, your response.
It's a problem, and it's not a surprising turn of events at the New England Journal with the new editor who's come on in the last year. I think that if he's a bit in the pocket of the pharmaceutical industry himself, so it's not a big surprise. It's a big problem because review articles are subjective, unlike original studies, and if the authors of the review articles have received a good amount of money from the industry, they're likely to be influenced, as all literature to date shows in similar cases. And I think that if the journal looked hard enough, it would be able to find experts who did not have significant stake in the companies that they're writing about, whose products they're writing about.
We're also joined on the phone by Jaya Agrawal, who is former president of the American Medical Students Association. Can you talk about the campaign that you began in medical school?
Yeah. One of the things, and we're talking a lot about the industry and what it should and shouldn't do, part of the problem, as Dr. Goodman mentioned, lies with the profession. I'm a fourth-year medical student right now, and during your third and fourth year, you learn a lot of the habits and the practices that you're going to keep with you when you become a physician. And one of the things that I see a lot of my colleagues doing when you ask a medical student, how are you going to treat this patient, they reach into their pocket and pull out a guide that's published and produced by the industry and to determine what kind of drugs to use. And if you ask them what dosage to use, they pull out their pen with the industry logo on it and look for the dosage. One of the things that I learned from Dr. Goodman and from other folks that are looking into this issue scientifically is that information is not ideal. That's not the best way to treat patients often, and it's not the most cost-effective way. Over the past couple of years, I've participated in the No Free Lunch program, gotten rid of my industry-sponsored materials, and have started just getting online and looking at the scientific information available that's not biased by the industry, and I feel much more knowledgeable and I feel much more confident about being able to provide my patients with quality care. One of the things we did last year with the American Medical Student Association is to push forward a resolution that encouraged all students to do the same thing, to get rid of industry-sponsored material and to start looking for non-biased sources of information when they're learning how to treat patients and how to provide patients with quality care. And the students that have participated in it have found it very exhilarating and very empowering, and many of them want to bring it to their colleagues. One of the things that we're doing is a pledge drive where students sign a card saying, I promise to practice medicine in the best interest of my patients based on scientific information and not based on advertising and promotion. And that I think, has really taken hold of the student population. One of the things that medical students are concerned about just starting to enter this profession is this feeling that the public is losing its faith in the profession and in the ethics of the profession, in the ability of the profession. And I think this is for them a way to take back that moral high ground and to sort of redefine and reinvent professionalism in this new era of very powerful commercial forces in medicine.
Dr. John Kelly, what are you doing about this movement that's saying no to the ball games and the fancy meals and the sponsorships of the conferences?
Well, I think the ball games and the fancy meals are over. Those are really something of the past. I think at the same time, though, the pharmaceutical industry has been a very strong funder of medical research. In fact, the leading researchers in the country typically work with the pharmaceutical companies because there is such an opportunity to develop new medications. At the same time as the research yields effective results, then education is a critically important part of this. And we would agree that with Ms. Agrawal, with the need to, for physicians to practice medicine in the best interest of their patients, and we think that physicians should and need to have access to useful education, useful information. The real challenge is that healthcare and information is moving so quickly that the practicing physician needs a way to get information in a timely way. And so we think the kind of information that they get either from the journals or through continuing education programs or through drug company representatives all can be extremely helpful as they try to educate themselves.
Dr. Dean, your response?
I don't have a lot of sympathy for the direct advertising or for the detailing. I agree that we need an unbiased source. When I was in medical school, there was an outfit, and I don't know if they're still published or not, called the Medical Letter, and they were incredibly helpful, non-biased source that would evaluate and compare the various products of the pharmaceutical program. But this, and so people would provide pharmaceuticals to their patients based on unbiased advice. The biggest problem, though, as I see it, is the pharmaceutical industry has exempted themselves from price competition. Again, we can't go to Canada to get our drugs. We can't get the generic drugs when they're available in a timely way because of loopholes in the Hatch-Waxman Act. We can't comparison shop because their base prices on Medicaid, they're not supposed to be going below. And only now are we starting to put some serious heat on the industry. We want price competition. Not just competition based on supposed advantages of one drug over another. Two-thirds of all the pharmaceutical research dollars in the last decade or so, based on a study published in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago, were spent on so-called Me Too drugs. That is, one company has a blockbuster drug, the other companies try to knock it off with a molecule or two difference and then go out and compete on that basis. But it doesn't lower the price. And we've got to find ways to lower the price of pharmaceuticals, and plain old competition is a really good way to start, and these companies simply don't compete based on price until we get them off patent. And now they've managed to extend their patents. We just can't continue to do that.
We have to break once more just for 60 seconds. We're going to be back with this discussion of the influence of the pharmaceutical industry. We spoke about politicians, but specifically on doctors and the medical profession in this country. Our guests we will reintroduce when we come back include Vermont Governor Howard Dean, who will be running for president of the United States, Jaya Agrawal, who is former president of the American Medical Students Association, in the Firehouse studio with us. We have Dr. Bob Goodman, who is leading a campaign called No Free Lunch, and our guest from the pharmaceutical industry, representing the industry, is Dr. John Kelly. We'll be back in a minute.
Won't speak to all the people of the world. Get up there on that platform. First start singing song until you know I wouldn't enough. Then I'd tell you what I'd do. Talk to the people and I'd say, rough, rough world, tough, tough world. Well, you know, things don't always go the way we plan. There's one thing we all have in common. It's something everyone can understand. All over the world, sing along. I just won't.
Want you to hurt like I do. Randy Newman here on Democracy Now! Breaking the sound barrier. I'm Amy Goodman as we talk about the drug company influence not only on politicians but on the health industry and the health of this nation in general. We have a roundtable discussion. Governor Dean had to leave. He is in Iowa, the governor of Vermont. But we are joined by Dr. John Kelly, Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, known as Pharma. He is Senior Vice President for Scientific and Regulatory Affairs there. Jay Agrawal, former President of American Medical's Students Association. In the studio with us, Dr. Bob Goodman, who is running a campaign called NoFreeLunch.org. Dr. Goodman, the response about the pharmaceutical industry putting so much money into getting information out, developing drugs, that's where it's coming from. That is the good that they're performing in society.
Well, again, they do lots of good, and they've made lots of good drugs. But as far as physicians and students and medical residents out of medical school getting their information from reps, I mean, let's face it, reps get paid and get bonuses to sell drugs, not to educate doctors. And in this current age, doctors literally can get this information in seconds from worldwide websites. Dr. Dean and Governor Dean mentioned the medical letter. It certainly still does exist. In fact, it's now online, where, again, a doctor can access information in a matter of seconds.
I wanted to bring Dr. Richard Klarfeld into the conversation, who is a medical director at Seattle Polyclinic. Can you talk about the new policy you have just instituted?
Well, our clinic's a multi-specialty clinic. It's been in Seattle for 85 years. And we're trying to evolve with the changes in healthcare and maintain a successful practice style. And what we've recently done is evaluated our use of generic drugs and found that we could see a lot of potential for improvement. And then we evaluated choices to try and institute these changes, and perhaps the most successful thing you can do is eliminate the reps from your environment. So we've begun a program to do that, and as the first step, we decided to try and manage access to the reps to our clinic, and we created a financial barrier where we were charging a rep $30 an hour to be in the clinic. That doesn't guarantee that they'd actually be able to visit with physicians, because about 30-40% of our physicians already refuse to meet with the reps. And so we've limited the number of reps, and to cover the costs and personnel time for our personnel to oversee this, we have this minimal charge.
Dr. John Kelly, representing the pharmaceutical industry, what is your response to this Seattle Clinic's new policy?
Well, I think that we certainly believe that physicians should have free access to pharmaceutical representatives, but even more importantly, they should have access to good information about pharmaceuticals, whether it comes from pharmaceutical reps or from other places. I think the real challenge that we face in this country is that as we develop new and better medicines to meet specific medical needs, the real challenge is physicians keeping up to date with this information. Just in the last decade, there are over 1,000 medicines that have been developed. And so that means that the kind of students that Dr. Goodman's in teaching, what Ms. Agrawal is learning today in medicine, in 5 or 10 years will be out of date. And so the real challenge that we face is, first of all, getting good information to physicians, and then second of all, really trying to help them get that information to their patients, because we just have so many patients who have unmet needs where pharmaceuticals could, in fact, meet those needs.
Dr. Richard Klarfeld?
Well, we certainly agree that there's lots of disease states where we could be prescribing more, where we could be more aggressive in managing depression, diabetes, hypertension, and lipids. But if you take a simple thing like managing lipids, where there may be 4 or 5 different drugs, which when you do clinical research all seem to have the same outcome, we think we can use that data, then take the most cost-effective drug and start with that drug. And the interaction with the reps is designed to create a personal relationship between the provider and the reps. So when the provider thinks, oh, I want to start a statin, they're going to pick the one that rep represents. And so to break that cycle, we want to eliminate the reps. The other things would be you have drugs that are very expensive, like these COX-2 drugs for anti-inflammatory conditions. They're anti-inflammatory agents to treat chronic inflammatory conditions, and they have no proven benefit over a simple drug like ibuprofen. So there's lots of opportunity to save money, which would be beneficial not only to the patient, but their employers and the insurance companies and the whole society. So really, that's what our goal is.
I'm looking at an article that was in the New York Times in May. Suit says company promoted drug in exam rooms. Newly unsealed court documents reveal that some physicians, in exchange for money, have allowed pharmaceutical sales representatives into their examining rooms to meet with patients, review medical charts, and recommend what medicines to prescribe. And some of those salespeople tried to influence doctors to prescribe drugs for uses that were not approved by the Federal Food and Drug Administration, the documents show. The so-called shadowing program, apparently involving hundreds of patients, is just one way that Warner Lambert tried to increase sales of a drug called Neurontin, not just for epilepsy, for which it was approved, but also for more than a dozen medical conditions it was never approved to treat. This according to a federal whistleblower case that's now the subject of a criminal and civil investigation in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston. The case details marketing practices that experts say have become standard practice for many drug companies as they spend billions of dollars trying to persuade physicians to prescribe their drugs. A recent study of physicians in Maryland, for example, found 37% said they had accepted some kind of compensation from the drug companies. According to court documents, Warner Lambert, which has been since acquired by Pfizer, tracked whether doctors prescribed Neurontin, rewarding those who were considered high-volume prescribers by paying them as speakers and consultants, and also paying them to enter patients in clinical trials. Warner Lambert also tried to influence doctors who wrote medical journal articles about Neurontin by paying them, sometimes secretly, and even hiring a marketing company to write first drafts. The drug is expected to reach $2 billion in sales this year. Dr. Kelly, your response.
Well, first of all, this particular case is from practices from a number of years back. I think that the kind of code that we've adopted now really would put an end to practices like this to the extent to which that they might still occur. I think it the real mistake here is to think that that an individual case or an individual set of allegations, in fact, really are characteristic of the entire industry. I think that what you'll find is a real commitment on the part of the industry to try to make sure that good information is available, it's timely information, it's accurate. I'm sure as you and your listeners know, this is a highly regulated industry, so that the kind of information that sales representatives provide or that are provided in advertisements are all reviewed by the Food and Drug Administration, and so the information has to be accurate. And then once accurate information is available, then it's up to the physician to figure out what's best for his or her individual patients.
Jaya Agrawal, your response.
I think that I would agree that the industry practices have been really aggressive, very aggressive, and very atrocious. And I would disagree with Dr. Kelly when he says that there aren't quick ways to find out up-to-date information. I think up-to-date information is at your fingertips with the click of a button, but it does take will, and the reason it takes will is because the industry is so aggressive. It is very difficult to walk from one end of the hospital to another without being approached, without being offered promotional materials. And I think that getting rid of these aggressive practices is the first step towards creating a more scientific environment in the hospital. So I do think that the voluntary code by the industry is going to help. However, I'm talking to you from Rhode Island Hospital, and I still see these practices continuing. And I'm not sure how effective a voluntary code or statements by the industry that they're going to improve their behavior.
Dr. Really Kelly says that they're trying to give you information to inform you about the uses of more and more drugs when they approach you.
Yeah, I think that the information is biased. I think that the information is designed to induce physicians to prescribe the most expensive drugs, not always the most effective drugs. And I think that depending on the industry for information or for other things. So, for example, I work in a free clinic, and the patients who come into the clinic have no ability to pay for their own medications. So for a while, we were using samples that were given to us free by the industry. But the problem is that once the industry loses a patent on a drug, they stop giving out free samples because it's not in their interest to promote the drug. Meanwhile, you have a patient who has been treated on this drug but now has no more access to it and has to be switched to another drug, which is not ideal. It's better to keep somebody on the same drug if it's effective. It's not ideal for patient care. It's not effective for patient care. And what happens is when physicians start using these free samples is they start prescribing it to the rest of their patient population, and it might not be the best drug. It's just the most well-promoted drug. Mm.
Dr. John Kelly, your response, and I mean, there are just a myriad of articles talking about the industry role in dealing with medical students, medical meetings. Recently in the Washington Post, a piece about the American Psychiatric Association and the drug companies courting of them, handing out hundreds of free phone cards, invitations to museums, jazz concerts. As thousands of psychiatrists streamed into town, they were greeted by a highway billboard advertising AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals' antipsychotic medicine Seroquel. Each of 19,000 attendees given a gray bag with the insignia of the meeting and the orange logo of GlaxoSmithKline, the maker of the antidepressant Paxil. Outside the giant convention center, curb signs for buses ferrying doctors to hotels advertised Eli Lilly, the maker of Prozac, and talked about how all of these booths were there, and they had center stage, while the patients' booths, organizations, for example, of patients to help the mentally ill, they were pushed off to the side. How does this further medicine, Dr. Kelly?
Well, I think advertising is part of everything that happens in this culture. Cars are advertised, radio shows are advertised, television shows. Advertising is just part of the American way. We certainly think that because of advertising, there's certainly many medical needs that are better understood by physicians and by the public. For example, we've been talking here at least at one point about the management of high cholesterol. Clearly, I think the public better understands that, physicians better understand that, and there are a variety of choices. I think the part where we perhaps differ a little bit is that certainly as a practicing physician and knowing and working with many, many other physician colleagues, I think that we have great faith that physicians will ultimately figure out what works best for them, what works best for their patients, and tailor the pharmaceuticals that they provide to meet individual patient needs. And so we think advertising plays a role here, but we also have tremendous trust that physicians, because of their ethical commitments, because of their scientific commitments, in fact, really will make an effort to stay as current as they can.
Dr. Bob Goodman, what about that trust?
Despite the best efforts of the pharmaceutical industry, I think Dr. Kelly has summarized it well. TV shows, drugs, it's the same thing. The industry should be honest. What they do is try to sell their products, and there's nothing wrong with that. What they're supposed to do. But doctors need to get accurate, unbiased information. To do that, they should get it from other sources than the industry.
And what do you, in this last minute, we heard about Dr. Richard Klarfeld's example, medical director at Seattle Polyclinic. They're charging reps to come inside. Do you have a list of solutions?
Well, that certainly I don't see as one, because I don't see there's any difference between charging a rep $30 to get into the clinic or having the rep buy lunch, which would probably cost more than $30. So I don't really see that as a step forward. I think what's needed is to educate doctors to make sure they know that there is this literature showing that this promotion does influence their behavior, and most importantly, that there are plenty of sources to get unbiased, accurate information that doesn't come along with a free lunch. And
what about the drugs? They were exempted from the Vermont plan.
The
free samples in the clinics. For example, Jaya Agrawal says they give them to in a free clinic because they can't afford the drugs. What do you think of this?
I would have probably included them, because I do disagree with Governor Dean in that instance, that I'm not quite sure that samples actually benefit patients, certainly not in the long term, because as Jaya pointed out, they end up being on expensive, inappropriate medications as a result.
On that note, I want to thank everyone for being with us. Dr. Bob Goodman at nofreelunch.org. Dr. John Kelly of the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, Pharma, Dr. Richard Clairfeld, Medical Director of Seattle Polyclinic, and Jaya Agrawal, former President of American Medical Students Association. That does it for the program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, Michael Yeh. Anthony Sullivan is our music maestro and engineer. Our website is democracynow.org. Our email address is mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Business. Digging up the tank with the shovel and the pick. It's a job. It's a job. Money mood rising with the plague and the fun. Doing the bob. Doing the mob. It's all over. It's all over. It's all over. And there's a leak in the boiler room. The poor, the lame, the blind.